Simon & Schuster Audio presents As You Wish, Inconceivable Tales from the Making of the Princess Bride by Carrie Elwes, with Joe Layden. Read by Carrie Elwes, with a foreword written and read by Rob Reiner and an epilogue written and read by Norman Lear. Featuring the voices of Billy Crystal, Christopher Guest, Carol Kane, Rob Reiner, Chris Sarandon, Andy Scheinman, Wallace Shawn, and Robin Wright. With Danny Burstein reading for William Goldman, Mandy Patinkin, and Fred Savage.
Forward written and read by Rob Reiner.
William Goldman once said about the movie business, "Nobody knows anything." The Princess Bride is Exhibit A in defense of that truism. As I was starting my career as a filmmaker, I thought naively, why not make a film based on The Princess Bride? That should be easy. It's a brilliant story written by one of America's greatest writers. Why wouldn't everyone just jump at this idea? Little did I know that for 15 years, it had been the story that no studio would touch. Fortunately, Norman Lear, my all-in-the-family boss, and the man whom I would come to call my second father, had faith in this wonderful, fractured fairy tale. Making The Princess Bride was one of the greatest experiences of my life, living in England for 6 months, working with old friends and people who would become old friends, creating a film based on my favorite book of all time. Nothing could be more satisfying. When you start a film, you have an idea of what you want it to become, but you never know if anyone else will share your interest. Bill Goldman once referred to the book he wanted on his tombstone as an oddball story. When it came time for the movie's release, no one had any idea of how to sell it. Was it a fairy tale? Was it a swashbuckling adventure? Was it a love story? Or was it just a nutty satire? The fact is, it was and is all of the above. Not easy to capture in a 2-minute preview trailer or a 30-second TV ad. We opened to some critical success, but only moderate business. Luckily, through VHS, DVD, and TV, it managed to take hold, and over the past 25 years, its popularity has grown. I can't tell you the pleasure I get from people who first saw it when they were kids, telling me how much their kids love it. What a thrill to know that a film that you've had a hand in is getting passed down to future generations. Reading Carrie's book has brought back wonderful memories. He has so beautifully recounted what for me, and I'm sure for all of us, was one of the truly great creative experiences of our lives. He takes us, as only he can, through the man in black's eye view of the world of the ROUS, Miracle Max, and the Cliffs of Insanity. And he does it with style and grace. So curl up in a comfy spot and have fun storming the castle.
Introduction. New York, October 2nd, 2012. Standing on stage at Alice Tully Hall at Lincoln Center, surrounded by cast members and some of the crew, many of whom I have not seen in years, I feel an almost overwhelming sense of gratitude and nostalgia. We have gathered here at the New York Film Festival to celebrate the 25th anniversary of The Princess Bride, a movie whose popularity and resonance now span generations. That fact alone boggles the mind. How such a quirky and modestly conceived film could achieve such a lofty position in the pantheon of popular culture. What really strikes me, though, as I look down the row at the faces of my fellow actors, is how quickly time has passed. Has it really been 25 years? A quarter century? The passing of time is most critically noted by those who are missing. The great Peter Falk and that gentle mountain of a man, Andre the Giant. But to counter that sadness is the camaraderie of being back with those who are here tonight and who stood alongside me so many years ago. Rob Reiner, Billy Crystal, Carol Kane, Wallace Shawn, Chris Sarandon, and Mandy Patinkin. Not to mention Robin Wright, looking as lovely as she did the first day I laid eyes on her. Then again, she has always set a rather ridiculously high standard for beauty, and that seems not to have changed. The only ones who couldn't make it were Christopher Guest and Fred Savage, who unfortunately were busy working on other projects. This is a night of red carpets and remembrance, of interviews and a screening filled with laughter and joy. It is also only the third time that I have seen the film in its entirety with an audience since its initial screening in 1987 at the Toronto Film Festival. That previous event, while successful, did not exactly produce the sort of response one would expect of a film destined to become a classic. Is it fair to call The Princess Bride a classic? The storybook story about pirates and princesses, giants and wizards, cliffs of insanity, and rodents of unusual size. It's certainly one of the most often quoted films in cinema history, with lines like, "Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You kill my father, prepare to die." Inconceivable. Anybody want a peanut? Have fun storming the castle. Never get involved in a land war in Asia. Life is pain, Highness. Anyone who says differently is selling something. Rest well and dream of large women. I hate for people to die embarrassed. Please consider me as an alternative to suicide. This is true love. You think this happens every day? Get used to disappointment. I'm not a witch. I'm your wife. Marriage, that blessed arrangement. You seem a decent fellow. I hate to kill you. You seem a decent fellow. I hate to die. Death cannot stop true love. All it can do is delay it for a while. Never go in against a Sicilian when death is on the line. There is a shortage of perfect breasts in this world. It would be a pity to damage yours. And, of course, as you wish. Classic, a small word that carries enormous weight, although sometimes it's tossed around a bit too casually. A reputation earned over the course of time and given only to those rare films that stand up to repeated viewings. That being said, The Princess Bride has aged remarkably well. I think this is in part because of the quality of the writing, the directing, and the wonderful ensemble of actors I had the sheer pleasure of working with. Even though it is the fans who have truly kept the memory of the movie alive, each of us in the cast has remembrances of making the film, things that have stayed with us over the years. All of us have stories about encounters or moments, like being approached and asked to recite a favorite Princess Bride line. Mandy swears that barely a day goes by that he isn't asked by someone somewhere to recite Inigo Montoya's most famous words, in which he vows vengeance on behalf of his father. "And I never let them down," he says. I read somewhere recently that a passenger on a plane was asked to leave the flight as his Montoya t-shirt bearing that infamous line frightened one of the passengers who had never seen the movie. After it was explained to them, apparently the t-shirted passenger was allowed to stay on the aircraft. Mandy himself has a long and impressive resume. The man has won a Tony, an Emmy, and countless other honors. But, like most of us at Lincoln Center tonight, he knows that someday his obituary will feature more prominently than anything else his affiliation with The Princess Bride. And that's just fine with him, as it is with all of us. There might be a shortage of perfect breasts in the world, but there is no shortage of actors who achieve a degree of recognition or fame due to the popularity, or in some cases the ignominy, which is an entirely different story, of a specific movie and their role within that movie. It can become a blessing or a curse, sometimes a little of both, depending on the circumstances. Over the past 3 decades, I've appeared in nearly 100 movies and television shows. I've been a leading man and a supporting actor, and worked in almost every genre. But whatever else I've done, or whatever else I might do, The Princess Bride will always be the work with which I am most closely associated. And Wesley, with his wisp of a mustache and ponytail, the character with whom I will be forever linked. Not Glory, which earned higher critical praise upon release and won more awards. Not Days of Thunder or Twister, both of which were summer blockbusters. Not even Saw, which was shot in 18 days on a budget smaller than most movies spend on catering and earned more than $100 million. And that's just fine by me. When I started The Princess Bride, I was very young and fairly new to the world of film. I was cast in a movie that frankly could have been interpreted as preposterous, were it not for the fact that it was so well written, so well directed, and populated with such a ridiculously talented cast. As I look around the stage at Rob Reiner, the director, and William Goldman, the writer, who so deftly and lovingly adapted the screenplay from his equally imaginative novel, I think how incredibly fortunate I was to have been part of this project. To have been plucked from relative obscurity and dropped onto a set with these two insanely talented men and this extraordinary cast. I'd be lying if I told you we had even the slightest inkling that our movie, made on a modest budget over a period of less than 4 months and shot in and around London and the magnificent Peak District of Derbyshire, was destined to become a classic. But I think it withstands the rigors of time because it seems to be a timeless story, a tale of love and romance, of heroes and villains. And, although the film is from the 1980s, there is nothing on the screen that betrays its birth date, notwithstanding perhaps the rodents of unusual size. Instead of a bouncy techno-pop soundtrack, you have the elegant slide guitar of Mark Knopfler. Instead of big hair and shoulder pads, you have the period style of a swashbuckler and a princess. Perhaps the only thing that serves as a timestamp is Fred Savage's video game at the very start of the movie, which, by the way, is where the film gets its first laugh. It is, of course, a movie within a movie, a story within a story, much like the book itself. Even in the scenes between Peter Falk and Fred Savage, a grandfather reading to his bedridden sick grandson, there is a timeless grace and elegance to the filmmaking. And then there is the dialogue. "They're kissing again. Do we have to read the kissing parts?" What preteen boy hasn't said that or thought that? Or at least something like that? It's the kind of dialogue that holds up. It endures. In fact, like a good wine without iocane powder, it seems to get better with time. The movie, believe it or not, opened to mostly positive, if occasionally befuddled, critical response. Even those who praised the movie weren't quite sure what to think. Was it a comedy? A romance? An adventure story? A fantasy? The fact is, it was all of those things and more. But Hollywood abhors that which is not easily categorized, and so the film didn't quite gain the kind of traction it might have deserved, grossing a respectable, though hardly overwhelming, $30.8 million in its first run, $60 million when adjusted for inflation. This meant it made almost twice the budget, but still only a tenth of what that year's top-grossing movie, Fatal Attraction, made only the week before. Within a few months of finishing the movie, we all moved on with our lives, putting The Princess Bride in our respective rearview mirrors. There were other projects, other films, families to raise, careers to nurture. And then, though I can't pinpoint the time when it actually occurred, a strange thing began to happen. The Princess Bride came back to life. Much of this can be attributed to timing, in particular to the newly developing video market. The Princess Bride came to be enormously popular in the VHS format. And it was via this relatively new medium that the film began to gain traction, and not simply as a rental. After careful scrutiny by those who do these things, it became clear that fans were not only recommending it to friends and family members, they also began purchasing a copy for their own home libraries. It became that rare kind of movie that was viewed and enjoyed and ultimately beloved by entire families. Copies of it were being passed down from generation to generation in much the same manner that children were introduced to the magic of The Wizard of Oz by nostalgic parents who wanted to share one of their favorite movies. So too was The Princess Bride uniquely family entertainment. Parents with their children and even their grandchildren could watch the movie together and enjoy it for what it was. There was nothing condescending or embarrassing about it. Nothing offensive. It seemed to be as smart and funny on the 10th viewing as it was on the first. Today, The Princess Bride is acknowledged and recognized as one of the more popular and successful films in Hollywood history. It is ranked among the 100 greatest film love stories by the American Film Institute and is on Bravo's list of the 100 funniest movies. And Goldman's script is ranked by the Writers Guild of America as one of the top 100 screenplays ever produced. All of these things, and a whole lot more, were running through my head that night at Lincoln Center. At some point during the evening, we were all asked what the movie meant to us. There wasn't time for me to adequately put into words exactly how I felt, so that's what I'm trying to do now with this book. The film really gave me a career in the arts and the life that I have today, a life I feel privileged to enjoy. That's not an overstatement. Other movies have surely helped, but this was the one that put me on the map and allowed me to stay there. I still get fan mail today from children all over the world, sending me drawings and sketches of pirates dueling or of princesses kissing them. I even have to be careful not to walk down the wrong aisle at Toys R Us, lest I find myself suddenly under siege by little tykes with plastic swords and shields. Everyone associated with the film has heard stories by now of Princess Bride weddings, where the bride and groom are dressed as Buttercup and Wesley, and the pastor even recites Peter Cook's dialogue from the movie. Or the late-night dress-up interactive screenings, not unlike the ones they do for the Rocky Horror Picture Show, where things like peanuts are thrown at the screen after Fezzik's now famous line. The Princess Bride nights at the Alamo Drafthouse Cinemas, a national restaurant movie house, have become so popular that they now produce their own licensed Princess Bride wine. I can't speak for everyone, but I consider it a blessing. Clearly, The Princess Bride has become a truly remarkable phenomenon. The film has literally millions of devotees. They know every line, every character, every scene. And if they'd like to know a little bit more about how their favorite film was made, as seen through the eyes of a young actor who got much more than he bargained for, then all I can say is, as you wish. Chapter 1. Meeting Rob. Berlin, June 29th, 1986. The note simply read, "Important." It was a message from my agent, Harriet Robinson, that had been slipped under my door by a bellhop at the Hotel Kempinski where I was staying. I immediately picked up the phone and dialed her number. This would be the call that actually changed my life. After I reached Harriet on the line, she began to tell me that she had arranged an important meeting for me, that the director of This Is Spinal Tap, Rob Reiner, and his producing partner, Andy Scheinman, were planning on coming to Berlin to see me. Really? Yes. What for? She said they were hamstrung by a tight pre-production schedule and were still looking for an actor to play the pivotal role of Wesley in a film version of The Princess Bride. Not The Princess Bride by William Goldman. I think so, yes, came the response. I couldn't believe it. This was a book I had read when I was just 13, and here I was being considered for one of the leads by the director and the producer. Fortunately for me, they did not change their plans. A little backstory on where I was at that time. I was a neophyte, just 23, with only a handful of films to my credit. But I already knew what I wanted out of life. I knew I wanted to be an actor. I was born and raised in London and briefly attended the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art, one of the world's most prestigious training grounds for serious stage actors. I enjoyed studying, but my ultimate goal back then was simply to be a working actor, preferably in film. Besides, I had already done plenty of studying when I moved to New York to attend the Actors Studio and the Lee Strasberg Theater and Film Institute. After leaving Lambda, I picked up an agent, Harriet, and started going out on auditions. I had already been a production assistant on a handful of movies, including the James Bond feature Octopussy, where I had the unique experience of being asked to drive Bond himself, Roger Moore, to work a couple of times. I was a nervous wreck, I can tell you. All that kept going through my mind was, what if I killed Bond on the way to work in a traffic accident? How'd that be? It would certainly put a halt to my burgeoning career in the film industry. I could already see the headlines, "Lowly Production Assistant Kills Bond." During one of our early morning drives, Mr. Moore actually looked up from his newspaper and said, in that very calm and collected manner of his, "You can speed up a little if you want to." By the mid-1980s, I had a resume that was short, but not unimpressive. My first movie, released in 1984, was Another Country, a historical drama based on a popular West End play by Julian Mitchell, with Rupert Everett and Colin Firth. I had co-starred with Helena Bonham Carter in Lady Jane, director Trevor Nunn's period drama about Lady Jane Grey, the 9-day Queen of England whose brief reign followed the death of King Edward VI. Apparently, this was the film that Rob had been able to see, and the one that convinced him to take a chance on me. After I wrapped Lady Jane, Trevor Nunn offered me an opportunity to spend a year in residency with the Royal Shakespeare Company, of which he was the director. I was flattered, almost to the point of distraction. Most young actors would kill for such an opportunity. But by this time, I was living in London, and I knew that spending a year with the RSC, as prestigious as it was, would be the equivalent of doing graduate work in theatre. The compensation wouldn't even cover my rent. Nevertheless, I seriously considered the offer, as it came from a talented director whom I admired and still admire a great deal. Might things have been different for me had I said yes? Who knows? I have very few regrets about the life I've been fortunate to lead. But this much seems certain. If I had taken up residency with the RSC, I would not have been free to accept the role of Wesley. In fact, I might not have even been considered. You could say I was rather lucky, for as it turned out, I happened to be in the right place at the right time. By the time Rob Reiner had started looking for someone to play his leading man, I had a body of work that was thin, but perhaps worth investigating. Through fate, or skilled representation, or a combination of these, I came under consideration for the role of the farmhand-turned-pirate Wesley, a character created in a renowned novel that had long been considered incapable of being adapted for the screen, and one that I had already read and enjoyed as a kid. How did that come to be? Well, it turns out my stepfather had worked in the literary department of the William Morris Agency in Los Angeles, and, after leaving to make movies, had produced William Goldman's very first screenplay, adapted from the novel The Moving Target by Ross MacDonald. The film version was released in 1966 under that same title in Britain, but was renamed Harper for release in the United States, where it became a modest hit and helped further establish the stardom of its young lead, Paul Newman. And it wasn't bad for Goldman either, who won an Edgar Award for Best Screenplay and subsequently became one of the hottest writers in Hollywood. Being a huge fan of Goldman's, my stepfather naturally kept a copy of The Princess Bride in his library, and one day gave it to me to read. Needless to say, I loved it.
William Goldman. I was going to California on a trip, and I told my daughters, "I'll write you a story. What do you want it to be about?" And one of them said, "Princesses," and the other said something about brides. And I said, "Okay, that will be the title." I went out and wrote the first two pages, and then I stopped. And then years later, I went back and finished the book.
I remember reading the author's own description of the good bits from S. Morgenstern's fictitious novel. Fencing, fighting, torture, poison, true love, hate, revenge, giants, hunters, bad men, good men, beautiful ladies, snakes, spiders, pain, death, brave men, cowardly men, strongest men, chases, escapes, lies, truths, passion, miracles. Now, if that didn't sound exciting to a 13-year-old, nothing would. When the call came from Harriet, I was in Berlin shooting a little indie film called Mashenka, based on a semi-autobiographical novel by Vladimir Nabokov, the man who gave us one of the most controversial examples of 20th-century literature, Lolita. The film was a British-Finnish-German co-production and was being shot in both Germany and Finland. This was the early summer of 1986, only a few months after the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, which had caused quite a fear at the time. Harriet actually told me that Rob and Andy had seriously thought about cancelling their trip because of the whole nuclear thing. My recollection is that it wasn't much of a concern to those of us working on our small European co-production. I recall a crew meeting being called on a set in a place called Katajanokka in Helsinki, only a week before, and being told that there was nothing to fear because the winds were in our favor and that the fallout was likely to be blown in another direction. We were warned, however, that as a precaution, we probably shouldn't drink the local milk, at least not until it had been declared safe. Like a good many of the others on the crew, I went back to work, scratching my head, wondering if we shouldn't be taking the whole thing more seriously. We were, after all, only 800 miles away from the accident. All I can say is that insurance policies for the film industry back then were not as sophisticated as they are now, so shutting down production wasn't really an option. Anyway, not exactly what you want to hear, but the show did indeed go on. And, as far as I know, no one got sick from the experience, thank God. The last few weeks of the shoot took place in Berlin at Studio Babelsberg, which is how I came to be staying at the Kempinski. I pressed for more information from Harriet. She said all she knew was that Rob and Andy were trying to meet as many British actors who might be right for the part, and that they were obviously interested in me. I subsequently found out that Rob had gotten a call from the casting director, Jane Jenkins, suggesting that he watch Lady Jane, and, if he liked it, fly out to meet me. It seemed reasonable to think that I was in good shape if they were traveling such a long way, and not only that, but to a region that might be contaminated with radioactive material. I wasn't accustomed to this level of interest, and, even though it happens quite often now, no director had ever come to visit me on location before. "Do I have to read for the part?" I asked, dreading the answer. "It's possible, since they're coming all that way," Harriet replied.
Andy Scheinman.
We were trying to meet all the actors who might be capable of playing Wesley. I seem to remember Colin Firth was one of them. We get a call saying there's this kid you should see. He's in East Germany. All I remember is it was right after Chernobyl. I'm not crazy about going to East Germany. I'm looking at maps, and they have gray areas where the nuclear fallout is, and I don't like it. So Rob says, "Don't go if you don't want to," but I did, and I remember running fast into the hotel like that's going to do anything, and literally leaving a $1,000 jacket behind. I didn't have that much money, and I certainly didn't have any other jackets like that, but I couldn't wear it anymore. I just left it.
As an actor, you lose far more roles than you gain at readings. You learn pretty early on that most things are beyond your control, and that it is better to let go and let God, and to get used to disappointment, as Goldman so eloquently had the Man in Black say in the movie. I kept trying to tell myself there would always be another film, another job on the horizon, that it didn't matter. But deep down, I knew I wasn't kidding anyone, least of all myself. This was far from being just another job. This was two of my heroes, Bill Goldman and Rob Reiner, working together. Although the novel was published in 1973 to immediate acclaim and passionate reader response, it was already 13 years old by the time I was approached to play the role of Wesley. Goldman's screenplay, which he had adapted from his own book, had in fact become something of a legendary property in Hollywood circles, having been declared by those in power at the studios as an impossible film to make. Having arduously penned the script himself, Goldman had long declared it to be one of his favorite among those he had written. High praise, given that by this time his oeuvre included Marathon Man, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and All the President's Men, the last two earning him Academy Awards for screenwriting. And yet, despite Goldman's impressive resume and passion for the piece, the project seemed destined to languish in what is commonly known in the business as development hell, meaning it had been passed around the studios a lot, with all of them either unable to get it made or simply uninterested. As Goldman himself once famously put it, even François Truffaut couldn't make this movie. It became this legendary unproduced script, even being mentioned in the prestigious French film journal Cahiers du Cinéma as such. And so it seemed that the author's favorite work was destined never to see the light of day. That is, until it fell into the right hands. For those of you unaware, it should be noted that Rob Reiner's career was on a clear upward trajectory by this point. No longer merely a sitcom star, he'd proven himself to be an A-list director with a deft ability to meld genres with his work on The Sure Thing, and especially This Is Spinal Tap, released in 1984. Everyone who cared about rock music or comedy instantly fell in love with the movie and memorized its largely improvised dialogue. It was the first, and maybe the best, of what would become a new category of film and television, the mock documentary, or mockumentary. And it was Rob who steered the project expertly from its conception to the cult status it now enjoys, even among musicians. Tom Petty once declared his fondness for the dim-witted, aging rock stars by revealing that he and his bandmates routinely gather and recite lines from the film before going on stage. Rob also told me that when he met with Sting about playing Humperdinck, the musician told him that he had watched Spinal Tap over 50 times, and that every time he didn't know whether to laugh or cry. For a director or writer, Rob's co-authors on that film were Harry Shearer, Michael McKean, and Christopher Guest, who would be among the Princess Bride ensemble. That has to be just about the highest praise imaginable. Around this same time, Rob was putting the finishing touches on Stand By Me, an adaptation of a Stephen King novella that would be recognized as one of the best coming-of-age stories Hollywood has ever produced. Later on, after I arrived in London, he arranged a private screening for me at Pinewood Studios, and I remember being deeply moved by it. I hadn't seen that kind of honest acting from kids since watching Truffaut's The 400 Blows. It was clear to me that from This Is Spinal Tap to The Sure Thing to Stand By Me, Rob was basically on a winning streak. His films were all very different in tone and genre, and they all ended up doing very good business. He was a director with a unique vision who made memorable films. There was really no one else doing the kind of work he was doing. So, with that impressive body of work behind him, Rob had earned the right to choose his next project, based primarily on what he wanted to do, rather than what was expected of him. Essentially, he was given carte blanche. As I understand it, the conversation between Rob and the then head of Columbia Pictures, which was releasing Stand By Me, went something like this. "Anything you want," the studio head told him. "Anything at all." "Really? Anything?" Rob responded with glee. "Yes." "In that case, I want to do my favorite book," Rob replied. "What's that?" "The Princess Bride." "Anything but that," came the instantaneous response. And so for a while, the project seemed to stall.
Andy Scheinman.
By this time, Rob's dad, Carl Reiner, had already been approached by Bill Goldman about doing the project. But Carl either didn't have time or couldn't figure out how to do it. For whatever reason, it just didn't happen. It was about 13 years later that Rob said to me, "I think it's a great book, and I think we should see if we can pull it off." At one point, we almost had it set up at Columbia Pictures. That's when I heard one of my favorite lines in the movie business. The head of Columbia said, "You've got to be careful with William Goldman scripts. He tricks you with good writing."
But, to Rob's credit, he was steadfast. Although he has an extraordinarily warm and generous spirit, and is not at all prone to the sort of rampant ego that is not uncommon among some of the upper echelon of Hollywood talent, he is hardly a pushover. In fact, it was his sheer determination and his vision that were largely responsible for making the film happen. Time has obviously proven that Rob was the right man for the job. Like most people who read it, he had been a huge fan of the novel. He also had supreme confidence in his ability to blend all the different genres that filled its pages: romance, adventure, fantasy, drama, comedy, action. He would take these elements and turn them on their heads. He would have fun doing it and, in turn, create a movie that would be fun for others. To accomplish that task requires a very sure hand, and I don't believe many filmmakers then or now could have pulled it off. With apologies to Bill Goldman, who dislikes the term, Rob really was, for lack of a better description, a young auteur, one whose success had left him with nearly complete artistic control over his projects. He was able to release his films the way he wanted them to look, as he had final cut in the editing rooms, something that hardly exists today. And he used his clout not to accumulate staggering wealth with superficial blockbusters, but rather to tackle something far more ambitious, something near and dear to his heart. How could one not admire that?
Rob Reiner.
I had been a big fan of Goldman's from the first book he ever wrote, which was The Temple of Gold, and then Your Turn to Curtsy, My Turn to Bow. I read literally every book he'd ever written. He was doing a book about one season on Broadway in 1968 called The Season. And my dad had had a play on that year titled Something Different, which Bill had devoted a chapter of his book to. Shortly thereafter, Bill finished The Princess Bride, and he sent it to my father to see if he was interested in making it into a movie. But he really didn't know what to do with it. I don't even know if he ever read it or not, but he gave it to me because he knew I was such a big fan of Goldman's. I was in my 20s at the time, and I hadn't directed anything. I read it, and it was just one of those experiences when you're reading something, you think the writer is in your head. Everything in the book was like, oh my God, I'm so in sync with this sensibility here. I mean, I just fell in love with it. It was like the best thing I'd ever read. And so time goes by, and I'd done All in the Family, and then I started my directing career, and after a couple of movies, I started thinking, well, they make movies out of books. I started thinking about what book did I really enjoy, and I remembered The Princess Bride was my favorite book of all time, so I said naively, I wonder if we could make a movie out of that. I had no idea at the time that a lot of people had already tried. Francois Truffaut, Norman Jewison, and Robert Redford. It was in one of those cinema books as one of the greatest screenplays ever written that had never been produced. I had my agency get in touch with Bill to see if he would be willing to meet with me. He had seen Spinal Tap, and I was just finishing up my second movie, The Sure Thing. It was still in a rough cut form, but I arranged a screening for him to see it. This was all just for Bill to agree to meet with me.
Apparently, the same studio head at Columbia ended up telling Rob, "You'll never get the rights anyway, as Goldman will never let anyone make it." So Rob decided to go ahead and try to meet with Goldman, who by that time had reacquired the rights to his own novel, to see if he could convince Goldman to let him have the material. He took with him the person who accompanied him to all his meetings, his producing partner, Andy Scheinman. It turned out the studio head had indeed been accurate in describing Goldman's reticence to let the movie be made. As Rob and Andy were soon to discover, the writer had evidently nearly lost all enthusiasm for the movie business. He hadn't liked the way the studios had dealt with him in the past, especially when it came to this, his favorite project. Nor had he had any luck with them, or with anyone else for that matter, trying to get it made. In order to better understand Mr. Goldman's frame of mind, I should perhaps furnish you with a little history about the various attempts to make the picture. As I understand it, at one point the project was initially a go at 20th Century Fox, which had purchased the book even before it was published, with Richard Lester, famous for the Beatles movies A Hard Day's Night and Help, attached to direct. That was when who Goldman refers to as the green light guy, i.e. the person who decides which projects are to be made for the studio, was fired at Fox. Then, as luck would have it, the next greenlight guy proceeded to clear his desk of all his predecessor's work, a surprisingly not uncommon occurrence in our business, so that he could start with a clean slate. Which is when Goldman bought the rights to his book back from Fox, unheard of to this day, I imagine, to protect his cherished work and prevent them from letting someone else rewrite the script. As Bill wrote in the 30th anniversary edition of the book, he felt he was the only idiot who could destroy it now. By this time, no other major studio was willing to touch the material but one. And believe it or not, the greenlight guy at that studio was in the middle of negotiating with Goldman when he too was fired over the weekend, just as the deal was about to close. Another small movie studio literally folded during negotiations. At one point, Norman Jewison, famous for having directed Jesus Christ Superstar, Fiddler on the Roof, and Moonstruck, was going to make it as an independent film. But he couldn't raise the money, even with a then virtually unknown Arnold Schwarzenegger attached to play the role of Fezzik. After that, John Borman, Robert Redford, and even Francois Truffaut tried their hand at getting the movie made, but somehow couldn't get it off the ground. And so it made sense that Goldman was naturally reticent to let his heart get excited all over again, only to be potentially disappointed. I guess he hadn't gotten used to disappointment when it came to this particular project.
Rob Reiner.
So I went with Andy to Bill's apartment in New York, and he opened the door and he said, "This is my favorite thing that I've ever written in my life. I want it on my tombstone." And essentially the subtext was, "What are you going to do to it?" And so we went into his den and we talked through what I felt should be done with the material. I had read one of the screenplays, and I thought they'd gotten so far away from the book that they didn't really capture the feeling of the novel. Bill was writing some notes down, and I didn't know if he liked what I was saying or not, but about halfway through the meeting, he gets up, and he goes to the kitchen to get something to drink, and I turn to Andy and I say, "Geez, I don't know. I hope this is going okay. I just had no idea." And then Bill comes back into the room and he goes, "Well, I just think this is going great." He was so excited about my take on it, I remember leaving his apartment like I was walking on air. I thought, my God, this is like the greatest. This guy that I admired so much was basically giving me a stamp of approval to go ahead. So then we went to get all the financing together and we got it made. But to me, the highlight of my career was getting William Goldman to agree to let me do this thing.
William Goldman. They came to my apartment and we met for a while. Rob had done some terrific movies that I liked. I mean, he wasn't Alfred Hitchcock, but he's a great director, and I liked him personally. You don't get offered that many things by good directors.
Fortunately for Rob and for us all, he finally got Goldman's blessing, which was a feat in itself. He then went to his mentor, producer Norman Lear, the genius behind Rob's successful sitcom All in the Family, and many other classics like Sanford and Son, One Day at a Time, The Jeffersons, Good Times, Archie Bunker's Place, and Maud, to ask if he might produce the film. Lear read the script and immediately agreed to finance the movie. The project was to be the second feature at Lear's new company, Act 3 Communications, the first being Stand By Me. Lear's only prerequisite was that the movie had to have a distribution deal at a major studio. Otherwise, he would be out of pocket for possibly the most expensive independent movie ever. To everyone's relief, Rob then successfully pitched the project back to 20th Century Fox. And, after a few false starts, Fox reluctantly agreed to distribute the film, whereupon Rob immediately set about the task of assembling a cast. The first people Rob hired were his buddies for two of the pivotal roles, Billy Crystal as Miracle Max and Chris Guest as Count Rugen. Of course, this wasn't just a case of nepotism. Chris Guest was coming off his genius performance as Nigel Tufnell, the dim but lovable metal guitarist in Spinal Tap. He and Billy were also both stars on Saturday Night Live, and Billy himself had starred in one of my favorite American sitcoms, Soap. As a young boy, I had traveled on vacation to the States in the 70s with my American stepfather. After my first trip, I became fascinated with all things American. There were many things to be excited about, and one of them was TV. You see, in England, we had only two TV channels, whereas in the United States, the cable explosion was just underway. As soon as I arrived, I devoured everything related to American TV pop culture, but I became especially fascinated with television sitcoms in particular, The Dick Van Dyke Show, MASH, Gilligan's Island, The Brady Bunch, and later on things like Soap and Taxi. Essentially all the classic shows from the golden age of television in the 60s and 70s, including, of course, all of Norman Lear's shows. I'd also listened to stand-up comedians from my stepfather's record collection, becoming familiar with the likes of Bob Newhart, Woody Allen, Richard Pryor, and Jonathan Winters. So when I got the call that Rob was coming to see me, I'm not sure what made me more excited, that I was about to meet one of Hollywood's most talented young directors, or that I was going to meet one of my TV idols. I understood exactly what was at stake in this meeting. There was no disputing the impact this role could have on my career. As is often the case when meeting with a director, I knew I was under consideration, but I didn't have any idea whether I was a front-runner or merely one of many candidates vying for the role. A German-sounding voice came over the phone from the front desk. "There are two gentlemen in the lobby here for you. Shall I send them up?" Rob and Andy had arrived. "Yes, send them up, please," I said, hanging up.
Rob Reiner.
Well, I try to get people who I know can do a part. I wouldn't just hire friends for the sake of hiring friends, but if they're right for the part, absolutely. The problem I had with The Princess Bride was that I had to get a young, dashing, swashbuckling kid and a young girl to play opposite him. And a giant. So it wasn't like I had a lot of friends that could fill those bills. I believe there was only one person that could play each of those parts. The movie has that kind of formal English fairy tale feel to it, that in the days of yore kind of thing. And so I wanted them to have an English accent, at least Wesley and Buttercup and Prince Humperdinck and Count Rugen and so on. I had seen Carrie in Lady Jane, but that picture wasn't a comedy, and I thought, he certainly looks right, he resembles a young Douglas Fairbanks Jr., and he's so handsome and he's a terrific actor, but I didn't know if he was funny. And this is like a very specialized kind of acting where you have to kind of be very real and earnest, but at the same time there's a slight tongue-in-cheek thing happening. You have to strike the balance. So we flew over to Germany, where Carrie was filming a movie.
What surprised me as I opened the door a few minutes later were two of the biggest smiles I had seen in a long time greeting me. There he was, the man who had created Marty DeBurgi and Meathead in my hotel room. The other smile belonged to his best friend and producing partner, Andy Scheinman, about half Rob's size, but with twice the energy. What struck me about these guys was their beautiful friendship. They seemed to finish each other's sentences. I was immediately taken not only with their personal charm, which was considerable, but also with their passion for the project. Rob was not only legitimately funny, which is hardly surprising since his father is Carl Reiner, but also very sweet, with an infectious laugh that could be heard in Detroit, as I like to say. In fact, the man I met was far from the beleaguered son-in-law of Archie Bunker, and man, was he a born storyteller. He was clearly very intelligent and a voracious reader, which is how he knew of Goldman's work. As it turns out, his father had also given him a copy of The Princess Bride to read as a kid, just as my stepfather had done for me. Now, that didn't exactly make us unique, but it certainly inspired a sense of kinship. I knew the story, and I knew a little bit about the history behind the attempts to translate it to the screen. I also knew that in the right hands, it had the potential to be both hilariously funny and heartwarming. I sensed that Rob, given his body of work and his sensibility, was the right man for the job. I offered them each a bottle of water from the minibar. I have a distinct recollection of Andy being so unnerved by the prospect of being so close to Chernobyl that he didn't want to touch anything, let alone drink the water. "So, as you probably know, we're making a movie about the Princess Bride, and we think you make a great Wesley," Rob said after settling into a chair. Rob has that easy way of getting straight to the point in a funny manner. The "as you probably know" sounded almost lyrical, almost as if he were dragging it out in a sing-songy way. I think my response was something fairly innocuous, like, "Yeah, I heard, that's great." In my mind, I was thinking, "Please don't make me have to read." "Well, we're prepping in London already, and we'd like to talk to you about coming on board." This was getting better by the minute. His demeanor was casual and friendly. He had a wonderful way of putting you at ease. And as we began to chat, my anxiety slowly melted away. Rob seemed surprised to learn that I had spent considerable time in America and was intimately familiar with the world of 1970s television. Here I was, a British actor working on a film in Berlin, and our conversation revolved largely around my recounting favorite episodes of All in the Family. We segued into a larger discussion of comedy and pop culture. Then Bill Cosby came up, and somehow, I don't quite recall how, I found myself doing a Fat Albert impersonation, which Rob seemed to like. I explained to them that I had gone to Sarah Lawrence College, as well as having attended the other prestigious establishments in New York. We talked about Saturday Night Live. Again, Rob seemed pleased that I was such a fan of SNL. I didn't understand at the time why this was so important to him, but it wouldn't be long before I'd get the point. I knew a certain look was required for the role of Wesley, and I suppose I fit the bill in that regard. But then, so did 1,000 other young actors. But they were also looking for someone with a sense of humor. And maybe I had a chance at being able to make these guys laugh, which I had surprisingly accomplished with the Fat Albert impersonation. It was looking good, right up until tragedy struck. "Look, I already think you might be the right guy for this," Rob said. "But do you mind if we just read a couple of lines, just so I can hear it?" "Why,
Why did he have to make me read? It was going so well up to that point.
Okay, here goes. The moment of truth. Reading the lines. The fact of the matter was, I had gotten more work from straight offers than from auditions. But I couldn't think about that now. I had to put on a brave face. Rob reached into an envelope he had brought with him and pulled out a copy of the script. He opened it to one of Wesley's monologues, the one in which he recounts to Princess Buttercup how he became his alter ego, the Dread Pirate Roberts, and handed it to me. I cleared my throat and slowly began to read. I was cold and unprepared, but luckily I knew the story and the tone of the novel. I also knew that many of the film's best lines would have to be delivered with a barely perceptible wink. After just a few sentences, Rob held up his hand. "Okay, that's enough," he said. I wondered for a moment whether I had blown it already. I had barely read half a page.
"Really? Are you sure?" I replied.
"Yeah, so how much longer do you have on this movie?" he asked.
I took a deep breath, trying to hide my excitement.
"A couple of weeks, give or take."
"Perfect," Rob said. "We're going to have a lot of fun making this movie, and hopefully, if the studio agrees, we'd like you to be a part of it."
I stammered out something in response, the basic gist of which was, "Yes, I'd love to, thank you." Was that an offer? Oh my God, I think it was. But then again, he had said, "If the studio agrees." Why would they question Rob Reiner, a man who had already shown great skill at casting his other hit movies? I quickly changed the subject, trying to act as cool as I could. I asked them both when they were headed back to London. Maybe I could get them to stay for dinner and convince them that, even though I knew the reading sucked, I was still the right guy for the part. But Rob replied that they were in fact on their way to Paris that very afternoon. This was a whirlwind trip for him and Andy. It turns out they were in the process of trying to track down a world-famous wrestler for the role of Fezzik, which is about all they could tell me.
"When we get back, we'll get in touch with your agent, and if all goes well, we'll see if we can work it out," Rob said. "If that's all right with you."
If that's all right with me, heck yeah, it's all right. It couldn't have been more all right.
Of course, I stammered.
We shook hands warmly and said our goodbyes. And I'm pretty sure I was on the phone with my agent before their elevator even reached the lobby.
"I think I've got this one," I said, out of breath with excitement.
"Okay," Harriet said. "Just sit tight. I'll give him a call."
Andy Scheinman.
Well, every once in a while, we found ourselves in a weird position. There was one woman who Rob felt didn't have to read for the part, as she was a well-known actress. She came in for a meeting and said, "I'm prepared, let me read for you." After she left, Rob said, "Oh no, she can't do this." And even though she'd been offered the role, we ended up with a different actress.
As soon as I hung up the phone, I immediately started having an anxiety attack. Was Rob serious? Maybe he offers roles to all the actors he meets to make them feel better. I felt he was a man who could be taken at face value. Best not to waste energy fretting, I thought. Another role would come along soon enough. But you could never fool yourself. I knew in my heart this one was different. I really wanted it.
Rob Reiner.
Carrie was very funny. He did a Bill Cosby impersonation. I didn't ask him to do that. He was just kind of naturally funny, and I thought, wow, this guy can really do it. He was the only guy I saw that I thought could play that part. The same went for Buttercup and Fezzik.
Andy Scheinman.
Casting was interesting. For many of the parts, we didn't have a second choice. We didn't have someone else to choose. We didn't have a second for Buttercup. We didn't have a second for Fezzik for sure. And we didn't have a second for Wesley. If we didn't find those people, I believe the last of whom was Carrie, then we didn't have a movie. To say Carrie was the last piece of the puzzle isn't quite true. Carrie was the puzzle. I mean, Andre was very important, but Carrie was the movie. And we didn't have anyone. We wanted Errol Flynn, and he had to be funny. Actually, it's not that you have to be funny, but you have to get the sense of humor. It's not go out and be hysterical, but you have to play the part with a little twinkle in your eye, which Carrie pulled off beautifully. I remember we sat down and Carrie opens the script, and he reads maybe 4 words, and we go, well, this is the guy. I don't remember exactly how long the meeting was, but it was just like, boom, that's him. Rob does this sometimes, and he's great. I mean, it doesn't happen a lot, quite frankly. But once in a while, someone will read, or they'll come in and they'll have worked all night preparing for this big audition. They'll be halfway through the second line of a 4-page scene and Rob will say, "That's enough. I don't have to hear any more. You got it. It's yours."
The next morning, Harriet called again. "Are you sitting down?" "Yes." "You got it," she said. "They offered you the part." I was speechless. This was no small leap of faith on Rob's part. I was hardly a household name. They could have easily cast any number of recognizable, bankable British actors who probably would have been deemed right for the role. But they chose me. In retrospect, it almost seemed too easy. Certainly, auditions don't always go so smoothly. And sometimes a meeting is just that. Sometimes you get the job, sometimes you don't. You just never know. I guess Rob knew what he wanted, and I was fortunate enough to be in his field of vision.
Billy Crystal.
So I remember Rob coming back from Germany after meeting with Carrie, and he said, "Wait till you see this guy. He's like Douglas Fairbanks Jr., but also really funny. He does impressions." And it's true, Carrie is a very alive guy, very alert, and you know, I love that about him. He's always in tune with what's going on at the moment, and when I met him, I got the same feeling as Rob. This guy, he looked like a young Errol Flynn, and very dashing, a very sensitive leading man who could also hurt you if he had to.
As Harriet ran through the details of my deal, I was blown away. I recall telling her to accept the offer right away, before they changed their minds. Chapter 2. Pre-production and meeting Buttercup. London, August 2nd, 1986. Within a few short weeks after wrapping Mashenka, I was back home in London, which was also the base for the production of The Princess Bride. Much of the crew and some of the cast were already assembling. Indeed, the first cast read-through of the screenplay was only a few days away. Soon after I arrived, I got a phone call from the production office. I was instructed to go for a wardrobe fitting with our costume designer, Phyllis Dalton, who had done fantastic work with one of my favorite directors, David Lean, on both Lawrence of Arabia and Dr. Zhivago, for which she won an Academy Award. One thing I knew for sure was that my costume was going to be first rate. I was to meet her at Angels, one of the oldest costume houses in London, and a perennial Oscar winner for design in that field. When I walked into the lobby, the first thing I noticed was an assortment of ornate costumes, elegantly fitted on mannequins. Upon closer inspection, I noticed that some of them appeared to be authentic, dating back to the 18th century. Within minutes, I found myself in an upstairs office where Phyllis, a demure and very pleasant lady, politely introduced herself. We sat and drank tea as we chatted about the role for a bit. She then leaned forward and grabbed a portfolio she had on a coffee table nearby and proceeded to show me some of the sketches that she had already done for Wesley and the other characters in the movie. It was all carefully laid out, with each sketch including swatches of the material she wanted to use. From the first glimpse, I could tell she had nailed the tone and feel of Goldman's book. The colors, textures, and the look of the materials were beyond what I had imagined. For Humperdinck and Rugen, there were fine velvet doublets with intricate embroidery. For the Spaniard Montoya, there was a mixture of brown burlap and leather. For Buttercup, her main look would be a flowing red floor-length dress, contrasting nicely with the black leather suede and cotton of the Man in Black. After studying them carefully, I turned to her and said, "Wow, Phyllis, these are really beautiful." "Oh, thank you. You know, it's funny, I don't really like doing sketches," came the unexpected response. "Really? But you're so good at it," I blurted out, trying to steer the conversation toward one of my favorite films of all time. "What about Lawrence? You must have done a few for that, surely." "Oh, that," she said. "Well, on that one, I had to do more sketches than I have ever done before." "Why?" I inquired. "Because a lot of the costumes had to be made in Damascus, and it was hard to get the tailors over there to do exactly what we wanted." She then told me she had already put together some rough costumes for Wesley, and that she'd like to have me try them on so that the seamstress could make any necessary adjustments. Her assistant then showed me to a dressing room, where, hanging on a rack, was the costume that would come to be iconic. A pair of black suede pants, black leather boots, a thin black belt, a pair of black lace ruffle shirts, black gloves, and a black mask. It was all very elegant and surprisingly comfortable. I tried on the great billowing shirt with its huge sleeves. I had already worn one much like it.